Welcome to Startups Decoded, where we uncover what it really takes to build and scale startups. I'm Andy Walsh, founder and strategist. Each week, we will bring you actionable insights and real stories. Let's dive in.
Hello, and welcome back to Startups Decoded. Today, we're looking at startups holistically, and I've got a really experienced guest in Mush Alali. Welcome to the show, man. It's good to have you.
It's good to be here, man. We've been talking about this episode for a while, so I'm happy we get to record it finally.
Yeah, we have. And we met through LinkedIn, and right now there's a lot of activity on LinkedIn. It's really changed. And Simply for us, it was a comment on each other's posts. I found what you were doing really fascinating, but also really insightful. I think that there's some people in the world that have managed to extrapolate startup process and turn it into a business. And I think you've done that very elegantly, and we'll explore that a lot today. To get things started, I want to talk about a pretty broad topic, but you're in Lebanon right now, but you've lived all over the world. And that global perspective is fascinating. But let's go back to the start, actually, as far as study, what you did and what you thought you probably were going to do coming out of that.
Yeah, that might be a long story because I actually have a bachelor's in biology, believe it or not. And I was a pre-med student in my undergrad days. I hated every minute of it. I'm able to say it out loud finally. And I went into the first year of med school. So I got admitted, started the medical school thing, hated that even further. And then I was like, this isn't the path for me. Like, I need to find something more challenging in a sense where, like, I need to solve big problems. I don't want to do like whatever doctors do. At least that's what I thought. And so it put me on a track where I went into business school, went into consulting, finally found a really cool company to work at, like Google, where I stayed there for a long time, and then eventually ended up in the startup world. But my origin story is not like, if you talk to my 19-year-old self and told him like, this is what you're doing right now, that would be insane to him.
Yeah, study is such an interesting thing. It's going to be something 100% that will change in the next 5 years as far as how we learn, how we get qualifications, whether that's in a formal institution, whether it's in a job that can do both. There are a lot of elements that will shift. My experience was when I was 17, 18, thinking about study, I had no idea what I wanted to do.
And 100%. That changed.
It changes 10 times over. But I think for me, the regimen of study, collaboration, learning process, like I did a double degree in marketing and exercise science, and I was doing biomedical science, doing a lot of research. And I think that process really helped me, like the actual anatomy and physiology and all of those things I would never use today. But there's all these broad range of skills that I think apply into being a modern founder in today's world.
100%. You can always kind of connect the dots and trace back like, oh, I know how to do this because of these certain experiences. So I'm not dismissing it. I'm just saying that there's going to be even more, like a lot of atypical career paths. Like you're not in a straight line where you're just moving forward progressively in a sense. And I really resonate with one point you said, which is like, what do you know at 17, right? Can you actually make a career choice for the rest of your life? As a high school student, you've never really worked. You've never been out in the real world. You've just been like cramming studies, whatever that means in your culture. And now you're like, okay, choose a career path for you. So that's definitely going to shift, either like willingly or forcefully. Like academia is going to be in some way disrupted, and people will rethink how they actually learn things or how they prepare themselves professionally, for sure.
Yeah, and I think if you look at young founders and you read stories now of people in high school that are starting businesses and having success, and there's something about like a naivety or sort of blind arrogance that allows you to do something without any guardrails at all, and you may fail fast, you may have huge success, but ultimately failure is a process and it doesn't define you. And I think that builds, I think, some resilience for you to be able to move forward. So people now are deliberately choosing startups versus study. And like that
100%.
It's tough, but you know, if you succeed, then I think it actually elevates you beyond people that are doing more traditional study.
And you actually pick up real skills as a person that are transferable to almost any setting you have. And I love what you said. Like, imagine you're a 16 or a 17-year-old founder and you start something in your basement or your living room or wherever you're living, and it doesn't work. But in the meantime, you've learned like how to identify really good problems, how to communicate these, how to pitch ideas, how to be able to iterate and understand based on feedback, how to adjust and learn. These are all skills that could be anywhere. And even within your little project or whatever thing you're starting in your high school days, maybe they don't work, but they definitely prepare you for so many career choices, including being a founder. Like, these are things that any founder would love to have as tools in their toolkits. Like, defining great problems, being able to come up with great solutions, being able to be agile and iterate until you get to some form of success. Like, this is invaluable today for any person in the startup world.
Yeah, and I think there's something as far as personal motivation in that. Like, if you study from an academic standpoint, you either get good marks or you don't. If you do that in a business sense, you may fail or you may not, but you're able to keep going as well. Like, a failure in academia feels like a failure in life, whereas a failure in business, I feel like you're able to go, okay, I know why that happened. So that test and learn and iteration that you do to be able to make progress. I think people, and I see so many, so many good young founders now that they're able to just roll with the punches and go, okay, I learned from that. It didn't work out anyway like I thought. And they move forward. And there's a maturity that comes with that, probably ahead of education.
For sure. I think if you have the right mindset, because also as a founder, you're so attached to what you're doing that rejection or failure can be really heavy on you as well. But if you have this idea of like, this is a learning moment, this is a moment of growth, this is something that will tell me what doesn't work, so I find what does work, then it becomes definitely a fantastic, even you, I dare say this, but like, you would even start to like failing, because, you know, especially at the start, if I'm failing, then I'm growing so much faster than I would if things were working out well for me, because all of my blind spots are being exposed. And so I usually say this to founders I work with, like, pray that you have all your failures very early on. Like, just make sure that nothing works out for you at the beginning. And that's fantastic, because then very early on, you've figured out the things that work and don't work out. And you can confidently build a little bit more as you move forward. And you don't get these nasty surprises in the middle or in the when the process becomes much more mature. So there's a lot there, but it takes a toll as well. When I started my other startup 4 years ago, I went from like the super cushy corporate environment where like so many things are given, and then I'm just working on my own all the time, and you're so overwhelmed. And I used to describe to friends when they would ask me like, what is the founder experience like? I would say it's basically getting punched in the stomach every single day and then coming back the next day for more punching, because like nothing's working for you at the beginning. You're so overwhelmed, you're so under-resourced, you just feel like, you know, what is going on here? And it's so painful, but you keep coming back. And so it's a bit sadistic as well, I guess. But and so if you can take it with the right setup, you know, frame of mind, it can become a really good learning. But I don't want to undercut the emotional impact that failure can have on a founder, because it's really heavy as well.
Yeah, that resonates a lot with me. And I remember that feeling so well. My first startup was in 2012. And I didn't think about failure. I was confident enough to know that what I had done previously would set me up to do what I was going to do. But there were times, like, we bootstrapped, and there were times when cash flow problem was like, okay, we may run out of money here, and then I can't pay for rent and food, take care of my family, just foundational things. But you have to be able to compartmentalize those things to try and maintain some semblance of mental health.
And I think another level of anxiety from a cash flow perspective is if people are expecting salaries from you, which most of your professional career you never think about. Like, you're an employee and you're getting paid every month and you're good to go, and then suddenly you're like, wait, I need to pay Andy by the end of the month. Like, how do I get the money, because the guy's been working for a month? And so that's another level of anxiety that you eventually experience when you first start, which is like, they are dependents on me professionally, and if you have a family, that's even more complicated. And so that really makes the process tough. But again, I really believe, like, in toughness you learn so much. Like, when you're exposed, when you're challenged, when you're pressured, when you're pushed, this is when you also develop skills and learn. So it is very much a mindset, like you said. If you have the right mindset, like, these challenges become fantastic growth moments for you, but they will hurt in the process as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'd love to sort of dig into two things that you touched on there previously. One of those is blind spot, and it's something that I'm so passionate about, like, learning and discovering. In that you can be so strong with your conviction on something that you learned a long time ago that may not be relevant now. And it's it's so easy to get caught up in your own little noise that your brain is sort of putting out there. But you have to be able to understand when something is not right and when someone else's opinion is needed to be able to give you that breadth to have conviction to move forward. And I love blind spot as an alternative to failure, because failure feels very finite in that if you fail, that's it, and there's no way to move forward. Failure is, say in research, if something that you want to do and prove, if it doesn't work, it's like, okay, it didn't work, but it's not the end. It just means that you learn and you've got 100%. A broader range of knowledge to be able to move forward. So I think that that as a mindset is something that you have to accept. And going into a startup is like when you, day one, you start your business, you have to be able to accept that there's going to be things that you test and learn that don't work. And that
100%.
The things that don't work sometimes are more valuable than the things that do.
100%. They are more valuable, trust me. Like, you learn so much when things don't work, because it pushes you to ask a lot of really good questions, like, why did this not work? What did the audience prefer? What kind of reactions did I see? So again, sometimes it's so much better to get really bad results at the beginning, because they give you such guidance on where you should go and they eliminate a lot of options for you. But the idea of blind spots, I think, for founders, if we really want to anchor it around the founder spot, is honestly the biggest blind spot that I've seen with founders is that they become so attached to their idea and their vision and what they think they're doing that they completely lose contact with like the outside world, or like some form of pragmatism around, is this solution needed? Am I solving a real problem? Like, am I doing something that has impact or not? Because, you know, I don't know, you might be a coder and you love coding and you're super excited about building all of these super cool features that you think are great, but you don't stress test these assumptions enough or validate them enough with people in the real world, with people who will eventually pay you for that solution. So that's really, I think most founders will have that as their biggest blind spot in their early days. And that will be a very painful learning moment for them, as it was for me and many other people. And this is what I do with a lot of founders as well that I work with, which is like, guys, we need to make sure that we're building something people want and that's worth it, and not ideas that we're just excited about, because it makes a huge difference in how the product develops and how the solution rolls out in the market.
Yeah. And going into that further, I'd love to get your take as far as when you are talking to founders, which you touched on there, if you have an idea and you're so passionate about it and then it doesn't stick, or if it doesn't work, it feels like it's a reflection of you rather than the business that you've created. So are you having those conversations to try and encourage founders or coach them to separate themselves from the business? And if something doesn't work, it's not reflective of them. It's an idea that you've tested that hasn't stuck. And then how do you move forward from that without feeling like you've let yourself down?
I think it's two things. So one, again, I love that you're focusing on mindset, because this isn't something talked enough about in the startup space, which is how do you develop a healthy mindset that can deal with adversity, that is agile, that is able to dissociate from the business. Because in the startup space, you are the business. Like, you're 100% focused on it. You don't do anything else. Most of the founders quit their jobs, they quit their hobbies, they quit everything, and they just focus on building this one thing. And so it does become a litmus test of like, if this works out, then I'm a success. And if this fails, then I'm a failure. So I love that you're talking about mindset. One more practical thing that I always work with when I talk to founders is just really manage the time you're kind of ruminating on an idea or a concept. The longer you spend thinking about something, the more you get excited about it, the harder it is for you to dissociate. If you, Andy, for example, you're working on a product, whatever it is, right? You're launching an app. And if you have this idea that you end up validating in a couple of days, it's going to be much easier for you to course correct and not take it harshly and not be like overwhelmed by feedback or even accept it, versus if you spend 6 months on it and thinking about the features and the UX and the UI and how it looks like and what you want it to do and maybe even developing it. And then I, as a user, come and is like, I don't understand how this works. You know, this is going to be a really hard sentence for you to hear. And most of the time you won't accept my feedback. You're like, that guy's an idiot. He doesn't know what he's doing. And so try to manage the time that you're just, you know, falling in love with your idea, and try as fast as you can to kind of put it out there to get feedback, because then emotionally it'll be easier for you to manage. Two, you will be able to course correct much faster. So these things usually help out when it comes to this. But honestly, again, like, I really resonate with the idea of mindset, because in the early days, the founder is the business. Like, there's no one else, you're on your own, or maybe you're a team of co-founders. So if you have the right way or mechanisms in your brain, a lot of things will go easy for you. But if not, then you'll struggle a lot.
And there's a saying that I wish that I'd came up with, but it's paraphrasing, it's strong convictions weakly held. So you need the ability to be able to make a decision, go after something, but be happy to be proved wrong. And that's fine, right? And it feels like, again, that it's attached to you, but it's not. Yeah. It's just a lesson to learn to move forward. So, but to pause there for a moment, as far as what you're doing with Rua Advisory, I'd love to be able to talk about like what that business came from and what sort of work that you're doing day to day.
So I'll tell you the origin story of the business. But basically, during my time at Google, I spent a lot of time exploring innovation and how do you bring innovation to in a business context. So eventually, a lot of the projects I would do would be like, oh, you're launching a product or a rebrand or you have this big initiative. How can we use, you know, creative approaches to be able to come up with great solutions for that? And so the creative process is very much straightforward. And people who know me know this sentence because I say it all the time. It's the easiest way to explain. You need to define which audience you're serving and extract an amazing problem from that audience that you think you can solve. Second is you need to come up with a great solution to address that problem. And you're either kind of presenting something that's different to what's out there in the market in terms of solutions or transformative that kind of completely pushes the benchmark of what's possible from a solution standpoint. And then three, you need to kind of validate fast your assumptions, the solution itself, and how do you develop it before you start over-investing. So you make sure that you're not moving in the direction that doesn't make sense. So that's the innovation process. And so four years ago, I was like, fine, this is the startup process. Like I'm just using this process in a corporate environment, but how can I bring it to the startup world? And I was like, okay, I'm going to build my startup and I'm going to use all of these processes to do everything in the startup, from like building the product, building the acquisition, building the strategy, building the fundraise, everything. And so it went quite well. And my first startup did quite well in terms of performance. So we hit almost 1 million active users a month in 2 years, like fully organic. We had a really nice pre-seed raise with angels and grants. So a lot of things worked well. And in that kind of context, I started connecting with other founders that would ask me questions about their businesses, like how do I do this on product or how do I do this on strategy? And so honestly, I was like, okay, there seems to be like a business opportunity here. And so why don't I open an advisory where I help founders on these things using a lot of my experience and my learnings? And so to go back to your question, and I know I'm a bit of a rambler, Andy, just so you to know. So let me know if I'm overdoing it. But to go back to your question, right now, what we do from an advisory standpoint, based off of all the experience I mentioned, is we help founders on three things. So how do you build your product and validate fast using innovation? How do you go to market to get your first few customers also in a fast way to be able to learn what works and what doesn't? And how do you do your first fundraise in the right way? So very early venture focus for early stage founders on these three core topics that make sense. And then we walk them through processes, or like, I like that you talked about, you know, I'm distilling frameworks because I am. And so I kind of have a framework about how to do these different things from a building standpoint, from a go-to-market standpoint, and a fundraising standpoint. And that's basically it. And it's been a fantastic ride so far from an advisory standpoint.
Yeah. And it's really, like, for me, a landmark sort of thing to be able to implement. I remember, my first startup, and that was building the business, but also building the operational process and then learning as you go. And it feels like that if you're able to roll out those three parts around product build, validation, and fundraising, it allows you to sort of catapult your thinking and escalate and move at pace to get to a point where you know where you stand, I think, much sooner than what you would do if you did it by yourself. But the thing there that I'd love to understand is founders, quite often, they have a level of confidence, which is a necessity. Yeah. How do you go into a conversation with them to sort of demonstrate the value so they go, yep, I actually do need help with that, and you're aligned on goals and success and what that looks like?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would actually say it's usually, at least from my experience, I do the other way around, which is, again, I assuming we're trying to see if we work together, I would start by asking you, like, what are the challenges you're facing, Andy? So again, like, you have this podcast. What is the biggest challenge preventing you from growing this into a, you know, a multi-million subscriber? And then we'll talk about this. And you can say, you know what, maybe it's the content itself, which is more a product discussion. Maybe it's the way we distribute. So it's a go-to-market piece or a differentiation piece. Maybe it's a, you know, funding or equipment, or you need specific ways to promote it that require. And then based off of this, you kind of slot in how I help. And so I usually don't try to assume that I know what makes the most sense for a founder. We have a discovery conversation. And within that, I try to see, like, are there spaces for me to help or not? And in some cases, there aren't. And I say, like, I'm sorry, but I don't know if I can help you, but maybe these some other people or some resources that can. But once we zero in on, like, you know, go-to-market makes sense for you, then we start talking about this. And this is how I can help you on go-to-market. This is what I've done for other people. This is the process and what it looks like. So this is what you can expect in terms of deliverables. And so that's the two-part process. I will be honest, obviously sometimes you guide, this is a sales process, so you guide people to like realization sometimes, or you guide people to whatever, but they're realizing it. It's not like I'm coming to tell them, you know what, go to market is a problem for you and I can fix it. Like, okay, why aren't you growing? It's like, oh, okay, maybe this is the problem. And then you move from there and that's how it usually works.
Yeah, and I think one of the words you said there for me really, really resonates, which is discovery, because you're not selling something that's tangible, right? For people, it's not like you're selling them a soda or a sweater. It's something, it's almost like coming in as a fractional co-founder in a way, in your ability to open up a conversation, understand where someone's strengths stop and start, making sure that you can complement what you're doing, but both of you have the right intention and mindset from the start about where you want to get to. So I 100% see the value in what you're doing, which is why we're having the conversation today. And I'm sure that what you're doing has evolved a lot too. And this is probably a whole nother episode, but building a startup today is different than what it was even a year ago.
Yes.
The way that startups are created and being able to do the three things that you're talking about, probably aside from fundraising, which is still quite convoluted, I would say that product build and validation has shifted dramatically. And how are you seeing that change happen with founders that you're talking to today versus 1 year ago, 2 years ago?
Yeah. I'm going to give you an answer, but I will just caveat this by saying, like, obviously things are moving very fast. And so maybe in a couple of months, we'll hit another level of sophistication in terms of, you know, technology or what's out there that maybe this becomes obsolete. So who knows? But this is very much linked to what I'm seeing right now. So I would say that the three elements that we did talk about in terms of milestones, so building, going to market, and fundraising, are being disrupted. And I'll take you through each one. But from a building standpoint, it's much easier right now to build early concepts of your business. Don't think we're at the stage where you can actually build real products that work and are functional and are mature using, you know, AI or no-code tools or everything floating around. I just had a different conversation around vibe coding right now. And so this is a very kind of trendy topic, but it is still a way to kind of build great prototypes and a way to be like able to build early versions of your product. But eventually you still need to get your hands dirty to come up with a great solution. So building is disrupted in that space where validation is much easier, but also competition with you is much easier, because if it's much simpler to build a product, then if you, Andy, build a SaaS tool that does super well, then I can just come in and copy your concept and build another SaaS tool and compete with you. And so there was a point where like startups, maybe not a year ago, but maybe 5 years ago and beyond, would compete on the value of their features. Like, these features were so great that people will buy your product and it was a sustainable or competitive advantage. Now this is something that seemingly will disappear. And so you need to think about it much more in terms of how do I stay relevant from a product standpoint before we even talk about branding or reputation or go-to-market. So that's where I'm seeing on build. If we talk about the go-to-market piece, again, it's much easier to go to market today. But the problem is you need, the biggest challenge that will arise for most people is this idea of defensibility. Like, how do I make sure that I build a business that can survive and thrive? Especially if, you know, in a sense, product is commoditized. So everything looks the same and there's no real difference. And so something that I now encourage all the founders I talk to or work with to do is to start immediately thinking about these things. How do you own distribution in a way that keeps you relevant? Or how do you own some form of proprietary data or IP that keeps you relevant? Because these are some of the, you know, moats that you can create to get people stay away from your territory, or to keep your product relevant. So this idea of going to market today is something as important as the build, which is what I'm trying to say. So distribution is super crucial. If all the products are equal, how do I get a great distribution to maybe get an edge over competition? How do I build defensibility as well? And so that's the second part. Third part on fundraising, I would just say that honestly, fundraising might become less relevant in the future, again, if building is easier and go-to-market is easier. And so now you have this bootstrap model that's coming up everywhere where it's like, it's never been more easy to bootstrap than today, which is kind of true for a lot of industries that aren't very resource intensive. So you might see as well like a shift in economics in terms of, when is it really the time to go get money for your business? And could you even build a business without a fundraise and just completely bootstrap it? And I think that model is going to become even more realistic in the next couple of months to a year or two, where you could literally, you know, Andy, with a couple of people, use a lot of the technology out there to build a successful business that makes money and not rely on investors to be able to make it happen.
Yeah, and I'm definitely seeing the same theme as far as my own portfolio, but also conversations that I have with founders The other part there that I think is interesting too, I had Nick Sober, who's a chief product officer at Avalify, on episode 10, and he was talking about also the pattern because of the speed to market and revenue much earlier than before, that we're also going to see probably earlier exits was his forecast, where an acquisition can happen in 2 to 3 years rather than sort of 5 years plus because of that. And the other part in there too, like sort of complements that, I'd love to be able to talk a little bit more around the moat, and you touched on it there. If technology is accessible and you're able to build something quickly, it means that anyone can do the same thing who sees the same insight or problem that they're trying to solve. So the validation piece is critical there to make sure that you have a product that's been validated and your acquisition process is easier and faster, and then retention is driven to a level. So the two parts around that, like that early exit, if you can get momentum and revenue quickly, like the acquisition process and having an exit strategy defined is going to be really important. So let's unpack that a little bit more. Do you think that if you're getting early revenue, are you talking to your founders about an exit already in their planning?
It depends on their ambitions as well. You know, certain founders want to build a business that endures. Certain founders have this idea of like, I'm excited about building, and so I want to build something, ship it, sell it, and then build another thing. So it depends on their personalities. But yeah, these conversations can come much earlier in the process. I'll have to be honest, it'll depend on the business we're building and the industry it's in. I don't think we'll have early exits in a lot of the more traditional spaces right now. I think it's harder to actually build a business because most spaces are very saturated. Like if you take, I don't know, fintech or health tech or ed tech, there are so many competitors out there. So how do you stand out? How do you actually build something that is in a way able to become a great business? It's or an acquirable business is a bit complicated. If you are in one of the new industries that are more related to AI, LLMs, these things could be more possible or easier at an early level. But right now, actually, the trend we're seeing is exits are becoming slower, or they take much longer times. If you look at the numbers, I remember seeing something from Carta recently on this. Because again, it's harder to get to a point where you're acquirable and the business is sustainable because so many things are happening in the market today that it's a bit of a more complicated play. So that's on exit. It's always good to talk about this early if that's important, but it depends also on just the founders, their personalities and their needs. Keep it in mind, but honestly right now, like building a great business is the priority, I would say, if we're really starting up in those early days, which is the founders I usually talk to.
Yeah, and if it's something that you're passionate about, it's sort of, I see it a lot with exited founders that I talk to, and they almost feel lost. It's sort of like they've had that adrenaline for so many years to get to a point where they exit, and sure, they might be financially independent, but they still have passion and purpose that they want to be able to do. So the alternative is to stay in the business. And if you can drive ARR to a level where you're making good money, and if you can do that with a team that's much smaller today because of the evolution of platforms that you can integrate now, and you're making a really nice EBITDA at the end of each year, and you're living your passion and purpose, it's like, why would you get investment and why would you exit if you're able to sustain that? And even, you know, that dream world of you might just become the chairman and dip in and out and have a CEO that runs your business, and you're just getting a healthy clip every year. That for me sounds pretty appealing.
For sure. I mean, two things. It depends if the opportunity for exits come. And honestly, it depends how much money you're offered. If you're offered a lot of money, you might be able to trade that life off. So it really depends on that situation specifically.
Yeah, absolutely. But let's not focus too much on exits. I'd love to go back to foundations of startups. So at that early point, we covered a little bit there, but I'd love to go into it a little bit more around the right tech stack. And if you're thinking about a product build, if you're able to do this very quickly, it means you're reliant on a product that may only been in market for a year, 2 years. Within that, what sort of advice are you giving to founders to think about with choosing and the claims that are made to be able to trust something that you rely on to earn money to be there in 1 year, 5 years time?
Yeah, it's tricky. It's very tricky. Because again, like right now, we're going to see a big wave of SaaS products that are half-baked because people are going into kind of this hustle mode when it comes to SaaS. So it depends. You have to do your research. You need to make sure. I would actually take a step back and say, like, from a tech stack perspective, first of all, it's super important that you think about what you need first and what your needs are and what kind of strategy you have. And then you go shopping for tools. Because a lot of the times people just get influenced by, you know, what they hear, like, oh, this tool is amazing, everybody's using it, or there's a lot of marketing or hype around something, and then you go for it. And then you need to figure out what kind of executions do I want or applications I want. And again, this is not the right way to do it. This is more like, this is our business, these are the things we're struggling with, what kind of tools can answer these problems? And then once you get to that level, you do some due diligence, which is what kind of tools are out there, which ones seem to be more kind of reliable or sustainable, which ones seem to have good testimonials or good feedback, what have I heard from my entourage. But just don't miss the step of thinking about your needs and thinking about what problems am I trying to solve, and then bringing that tool in, because that tool will not tell you how to use it and will not tell you like what kind of use cases you need. And that's something that a lot of people trip up on. And then finally, a very pragmatic thing, but never get annual billing on SaaS. It never works. Always get monthly. In 3 months, you'll see like, am I still using that tool? 80% of the time you might not be, and you can cancel that. And so sometimes this idea of savings doesn't make a lot of sense. It must test of like, is this an essential tool or not? Because you have SaaS creep, right? Like so many people start getting so many different tools, and then they eventually end up with so many subscriptions that don't make any sense. So yeah, that's it.
Yeah, and it's something that it's easy to feel like, okay, this is a small investment and it's going to save us X amount of time, and you rationalize it, but then realize it's actually not saving you time or money, and it may not even be fulfilling the full need of what you needed it to. So you've got to be able to do those tests, right, and be pretty pragmatic about the role that it plays and is it successful, and put metrics in place to be able to measure and track that.
Yeah, exactly. 100%. Do your research first and then go to the market and shop. That's basically the main thing.
Yeah, definitely. A bit further on that, we're seeing the rise of agents at the moment. Yeah. So agents are fascinating. And I had a little experiment and I got a little bit impatient, to be honest, as far as it wasn't quite working for me. And that's 100%. Going to become automated, it's going to become a plug and play situation sooner rather than later. And there's a lot of companies that are making big progress in that space. So off the back of the tech stack, as far as if you're choosing one platform to build your product, and then you're able to integrate agents, what sort of things are you seeing as far as how people are using agents, and what role can they play in the future?
So one thing is, I am seeing what you're saying, that again, we're at hype stage for agents, where a lot of people are talking about, you know what, I'm going to build this one-man army with 100 different agents and I don't need anybody. But the technology isn't there yet to be able to do all of that work that it promises you to do. So again, right now in the moment we're having this discussion, I don't know who or when this will be listened to in, but that's important to point out. Beyond that, what I see work quite well for us as a business, because we do use some form of agentic work as well, is, you know, automated low-level operational types of tasks that are repeatable are perfect for agents. Like, these are the types of things you want to work for. And usually when people talk about agents, they talk about AI, and I think they need to start talking about automation more. This isn't about, you know, having some form of artificial intelligence making sales for you. This is just some form of repeatable tasks that can be done in a smart way with an agile tool. Like, you know, how do you go through your sales process and what are the milestones in it and what can be automated there for you to make it faster or more scalable? And so that's kind of the main thing that I try to think about when I think about automation for or agents for our business, which is more the automation front. And then we did a bit of research in the team, and there's really like 4 big things you can use an agent for today. So either like coding, and it's kind of a co-pilot that helps kind of troubleshoot your code or give you some snippets that you can use. Then there's an element on sales. So how can it do sales for you? Either automate the tasks or do it at scale, which now, I mean, you're on LinkedIn, I'm on LinkedIn, we see it all the time. Like, we're spammed with like all of these things that they're just agents sending us, you know, messages or whatever it is. Then customer support. And then finally, you have some form of, sales, customer support, coding. There's a 4th one that clearly isn't important if I can't remember it. But yeah, so these are the types of tasks that I feel agents will have a great role to play in. Right now, if you're a founder looking to think about how to use agents, I would just say, like, again, low-level repeatable processes would make a lot of sense. I think there are some roles to play in sales for sure, where once you go to market, how do you scalably reach a lot of customers without you having to do the work manually? That could make sense. But I would, again, I would take this with a grain of salt, just because if done poorly, like, this can really ruin your image. And we get this a lot. Like, you get this as well. Like, you get a terrible message from a stranger and you're like, I'll never work with this company because why are they reaching out to me? The text makes no sense. So we have to be careful of this. But yeah, these are some of the applications I would think about. And I would think about, again, not intelligence, but more automation when I'm thinking about agents today, at least.
Yeah. And I saw a great example someone shared on LinkedIn the other day. And theirs was a customer service email exchange, and they were able to build it where it could trawl consistent body of information that was regularly updated from the website, from documents, etc. And an inquiry that came through, they would go through, and I think they had a 75 or 80% confidence level that if they hit that with a reply, it would give a personalized response to someone through Gmail that they plugged it into. And if it wasn't confident, it would queue it up for the founder to then either adjust it or approve it to send it back out. So that repetition to be able to leverage a body of information that the founder feels confident on. So that's just something that allows you to be timely. And it's one of the things that I've seen is that the automation of sales, and it's a great segue for us to go into go-to-market shortly. The automation of sales means that you may potentially generate 20 leads in a day, but you can only talk to 5 of them. And if you don't talk to those other 15 for another week, there's a high chance that you'll lose them. So you also need to think about resource planning and automation, and what you're actually creating is a lost opportunity. So you burn an opportunity before it even gets to a point where you can have a conversation. And is that something that you're seeing too?
Yeah, no, for sure. Again, it has to be executed in the right way. I'm not like full in on agents today. I'm sold on the idea. I know we'll get there, but we're not there yet. So definitely I would say, agreeing with you, sales and customer support, there's a lot of things that automation can do for you right now, especially that within the sales process. Again, as you mentioned, speed makes a huge difference. Like if you send me a lead today, or if you inquire today and I reply to you immediately, you're a much higher likelihood to convert than if I reply to you in 4 or 5 days. And so again, if you're a solo founder or a group of founders, this can help do things for you. I need to put, though, my early stage hat on, because I do work with early stage founders. There is value in doing the work yourself, talking to customers, being able to understand what they want and what they do before you go into that scalable mode, because you need to map out your process. You need to understand, like, what are the steps that get to a sale? What are the reasons sales drop off and they don't work? What messages work? What messages don't work? And so that's why I would say I'm kind of half-half on this agent thing, because the brand promise is amazing. I'm going to send you like 10,000, you know, cold emails, and I'll get you 100 different customers in one day, which is great. But you are skipping out on a major part of the founder experience, which is learning what works and what doesn't work from an acquisition and sales standpoint. And so it took a bit of a tangent from what you said, but it's just important to me to highlight this, that like in those early days, doing the work yourself has a lot of value for you and will keep giving you value, at least for now, until you move forward with your business. Otherwise, once you have the process mapped out, once you know what are the things that make sense, then automation can come in, because it can take the bulk or the heavy lifting of what you've already learned out of your lap, so you can focus on other things. So that's how I would see it.
Yeah, and what you said there, I 100% agree. As far as that dynamic feedback that you get from those sales conversations, thinking through a traditional sales funnel, every stage of progress when you move from stage 1 to 2 to a customer, like within that process is things that you see and hear that allow you to be more effective. So if you're not having that in-person sort of feedback loop, there's things that you miss. So again, your effectiveness starts to decrease a lot, because you're just sort of going for the spray and pray model and not being effective with what you're doing. So there's definitely something to be considered as far as how do you have a human element combined with automation that maximizes both, so you can be effective, right?
100%. And again, sales is another form of iteration and feedback loops. So even for me, like I do sales for my business, and I started last year with Ruya, and the product that I was pushing last year has nothing to do with what we do today. And it was literally based off coming into meetings, presenting what we do to clients, looking at their reactions, their feedbacks, are they excited or not about the solution itself? What do they think of the price point? Are we able to close or not? And all of these are signals for you to be able to course correct and adjust what you do as an offering, because these are the people that are paying you. They are giving you signals on like, I want to buy this or not. And so this is invaluable, and I wouldn't have learned any of it if I went for automation right away off the bat. But now we do use automation because our process is a bit clearer. I know what we're selling. The product is quite solid. It has some appeal. And so now it's much more about, okay, how do we do this faster or in a more scalable way using technology? And that makes more sense right now at this point of the process.
Yeah, the advice in that for me that I see too is that when you're in growth hacking early stage, you have to have real feedback. You have to have that human element. When you get into the scale phase where you actually have historical data that you can use and trust but continue to validate, you actually can scale because you've got a higher level of confidence to be able to put more people or more automation into a system and being able 100%. To control that to a certain degree with what you're doing. So I think that's great advice. And to sort of look at your growth then as far as your own business that you've started.
Yeah.
You're looking at an online course, which I'd love to learn more about. So you're taking the collective knowledge of what you've built as at a human level and starting to put it into an online course. So tell us a little bit about
it. And scaling it, it with automation, I guess, yeah.
Yeah, it's fascinating. So tell me about BuildOS. Yeah.
Yes, I will tell you. So hopefully by the time this podcast is out, the product will be launched. It was supposed to launch in Jan, by the way, just to let you know how delayed we are. But it's because we have a big pipeline of customers, so that kept us busy, which is not a bad thing. But yeah, and so last year, we worked with a lot of founders on launching their idea into validation and builds. Like that was a big part of what we did with a lot of our customers. And so the process that we came up with is called BuildOS. It's a series of steps on how do you do fast validation and be able to get something, you know, to some form of semi-mature build fast enough. And it pulls on a lot of the experiences I have. So obviously innovation processes. So there's a lot of design thinking in that, design sprints, the double diamond, like all of the different concepts that exist on how do you build, you know, solutions that stick. Then we kind of adapted it to startup specifically, because these processes are very general. So how does it work in a startup context for founders that are resource constrained? And it worked quite well. And that was one of the products that sold well for us in terms of what people wanted to work with us on. And so the next step was like, okay, how do we take this to the next level? One, to be able to have more impact with businesses, because I have an ambition to help at least 100 different founders this year. And I don't know how I can do this on a one-to-one level, but I can scale it with some form of technology. Two, I also want to start graduating our engagements where instead of doing the zero-to-one stuff that is very repeatable from a project standpoint, maybe people can go for like these self-serve experiences and do the basic work themselves. And then they come back to us and we do some more, you know, higher level or like custom work that is much more exciting for us than for them. And so this is kind of the idea of the system, which is like, we have a process that works well, how do we get it to a lot of different people? And how do we get a lot of people to do kind of the initial phases on their own and then come back to us once they're ready to do, you know, the bigger, meatier, juicier, more interesting stuff? And that's how the BuildOS story came to be. And so now very soon, hopefully, in Arabic we say inshallah, I don't know if you know that or not, but yeah, it's hopefully we'll be able to launch soon on how do you go from idea to fast validation in 24 to 48 hours even. Going through the steps I mentioned, which is what is the right way to think about your audience? How do you find a great problem within that audience? How do you think up of a solution that can have an impact, and how do you prototype and test fast? And once you do that, you'll have kind of a cycle and a set of tools that you'll be able to use to keep iterating in your build and your product. And so very excited about this, very ready to launch it, really. Like my team hates me because this has been taking such a long time. So hopefully in April will be out.
And it's great validation for the work that you're doing to get to a point where you see the opportunity to turn it into a really structured process that can be automated to a certain degree and allow more people to access that knowledge base of what you're doing. And I know, and I can definitely talk very confidently around the strength of what you're doing, like your go-to-market playbook that you shared on LinkedIn. I have it as a tool and I have my own version, and I've gone through and sort of evolved what I was doing. I think it's fantastic, and I don't work purely in go-to-market. I'm like you, I'm very broad, my skill sets, but it's so good. And I think that people will get a lot of value out of what you're doing. And I think it's probably a good way to wrap up today. Because I'm going to share a lot of information in the show notes about you and your business. But if you're a founder and you're early stage or you haven't even started yet, why would people come to you and what sort of help would you recommend in those early stages?
So why would they come to me? They would come to me because they'd like to get their project executed in a way that hopefully, you know, is successful and gets them to a point where they can launch a great business out of it, which is really what all the founders that are at the idea stage are. Because, you can be in different spaces, right? You could be a student who wants to kind of be the next, you know, founder that came out of a garage or whatever. You can be a corporate employee that hates their job and wants to finally go after that idea that they've been, you know, putting on the side for too long. And so if you want to do it in a way that's structured, in a way that's proven, in a way that will help you kind of skip a lot of the mistakes and get to validation faster, then hopefully we can work together on this. And you'll also acquire a lot of skills that will just help you in your journey professionally, which are the skills that I've mentioned as well.
So good and so important. And this has been a really healthy conversation. And I could talk about this stuff for ages. It's like my sweet spot as far as that early stage and the hustle that goes around it. And having gone through it a few times and come out the other side, it's so fun and it's so intense that we talked about. But I appreciate you sharing your time today, Masht. It's been a really, really insightful conversation for me.
My pleasure, man. It was great. What a fun experience for this. So I'm really happy we got to do it.
Amazing. Thank you. You're listening to Startups Decoded. Follow, share, and give us a positive rating. We'll be back next Wednesday. Thanks for joining. I'll see you next time.